From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Fillmore.
I'm from San Jose.
I'm from the Intermission.
UCCC World.
West Oakland.
East Oakland.
Coming up, we'll hear from the Dreamers, undocumented students who today became eligible for temporary legal status in the U.S.
They've had to be compromised in so many ways. We are so thankful for this glimmer of hope, this glimmer of relief.
Then young job seekers get a resume boost with local tech companies.
If we could show you a pipeline of pre-trained, pre-screened, cost-effective talent, would you be interested?
And you think consistently recycling in your home is hard? Imagine getting thousands of patients and employees at a hospital to separate their paper and plastics.
Pretty much very little of it, almost none of it is recycled.
That's today on Cross Currents. This morning, thousands of young undocumented immigrants became eligible for temporary legal status in what's considered the most expansive immigration policy to take effect in 25 years. It's called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and it grants undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children access to work permits and temporary protection from deportation. They call themselves Dreamers, and about 50 of them gathered at Grace Cathedral today. KLW's Ashley Ann Krigbaum was there.
Good morning. Well, let's have a round of applause for all the Dreamers that today are going to be able to apply for deferred action. Let's hear it.
My name is Emmanuel Valenciano.
Hi, good morning. My name is Cynthia Moreno.
Buenos dias. Mi nombre es José Hernandez.
I am 24 years old and an undocumented student attending San Francisco State University.
I'm a young mother. I have a newborn.
Y soy un estudiante de Phillips Halliburton High School.
Father Richard Smith from St. John the Evangelist Episcopal Church.
Statistics show that 70% of the people deported from California under the Secure Communities Program, 70%. Have committed either no crime or only a very small misdemeanor.
My parents forbade me from telling anybody about my situation, so I had to lie about why I could not do the things that others could do.
It's time to rebuild trust. The Reverend Debbie Lee from the Interfaith Coalition for Immigrant Rights.
They've had to hide so much. They've had to be compromised in so many ways. We are so thankful for this glimmer of hope. This glimmer of relief.
Having a work permit, I'll be able to get a part-time job. Not only that, I was able to get a driver's license. With a deferred action, it would allow me to go from school to work. Deferred actions open up so many new possibilities for me in order to further my education and my goals.
We also hold in our hearts those who do not qualify for many small reasons. They're too old. They may have a misdemeanor. For those to whom this is a day of still another day of disappointment, of a day of prolonged opportunity to be fully part of our community. We pray for them, we hold them, we comfort them, and we encourage them to know that we're not giving up and we're not stopping.
Yes. Those Dreamer voices were gathered by KLW's Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Matt O'Brien has been following the Dreamers and deferred action closely for the Bay Area News Group. He spoke earlier today about the significance of the new policy with KLW's Martina Castro.
What it does, basically, is it doesn't provide legal permanent residency or citizenship to the people who are eligible, but it does give them 2-year temporary but renewable work permits, which allow them to work. And it also protects them from being deported.
So who qualifies for this?
Anybody who was an immigrant who was brought here illegally before they were the age of 16 and who are now either 30 years old or younger than that. So there's about various estimates by the Pew Hispanic Center and the Migration Policy Institute estimate there's about 1.7 million people around the country who could be eligible, although a lot of those people are too young to apply right now. Also, to apply along with the age requirements, you have to have graduated from high school or be in school right now or get some kind of high school equivalency like a GED. You could also have been a military veteran, and you cannot have committed any serious crimes in the time that you've lived in the United States, and you've had to also been living continuously in the United States since 2007.
So the undocumented youth that have been mobilizing around this issue have called themselves the Dreamers, but this is very different from the Dream Act, correct?
The biggest difference is that because this is an administrative policy, it cannot grant permanent legal residency, what we know as green cards or citizenship, or a path to citizenship to the people that benefit. That has to come from Congress, and the Dream Act, which was first proposed 11 years ago, it was a bipartisan effort for much of the time that it was debated in Congress, would have granted probably the same group of people who are under 30 or 35, more permanent benefits like legal residency and a path to citizenship, which can come 5 years after you get a green card. But that's not happening here. This is just a temporary solution, is what the Obama administration says, to not deport the people who are here who would have probably qualified for the Dream Act if it had passed.
So what are the critics of this saying? What are people on the other side? Are they taking up the fact that it is temporary and not permanent solution to immigration reform?
The critics are saying a couple of things. One is they're focusing on the high unemployment rates right now and the recession. If this would bring more than 1 million people who would be able to get work permits into the legal job market, then that, they say, would create more competition between U.S. citizen and legal immigrant workers. A lot of those people are working here anyway, but this would allow them to get into jobs that they were not able to get before, usually higher paying jobs and professional jobs. Another criticism is that this is coming from executive decisions within the Obama administration as opposed to from Congress, which regulates immigration. Congress, the Republicans in Congress blocked the Dream Act from passing in 2010, and they see this as trying to bypass their opposition to do kind of administrative policy within the executive branch. The Obama administration says that this is actually within the discretion that immigration agents always had in being able to decide who is going to be deported and who isn't.
But there's no denying that this is an election year, and it certainly is playing into somehow election year politics. What do you think about this move by the Obama administration now? Do you think it's an attempt to court the Latino or immigrant vote?
I think that's part of it. It's a big risk, though. It's definitely very popular among Latino immigrant communities, and that could make a difference. Not sure how big a difference in swing states with a large Latino population, like in Nevada and other parts of the Southwest and some parts in the East Coast as well. It also angers some of the Republican base, but those may be people that wouldn't have approved of Obama anyway. So that may be one of the things that they're considering when they decided to do this. But it is pretty unprecedented, and it'll be hard to say for sure.
The last time that this was done, or something this sweeping was done, was 25 years ago, right?
Yes. This is the biggest immigration relief measure since 1987, which was at the end of the Reagan administration, when Congress passed and Reagan signed what's known as the immigration amnesty that allowed about 2.7 million people around the country to get green cards and citizenship. Now, that's a big difference than what's happening now. But in terms of the scale, this is definitely the biggest relief measure since then.
But given how temporary it is, this is definitely not a permanent solution to immigration reform. What are the next steps, do you think, in this process?
The Obama administration said that it's going to keep pushing for the Dream Act, and that this is a temporary measure. I think it's not totally clear what the Romney campaign has said, that they don't support this temporary measure, and that if elected, he would supplant it with something else, but he hasn't been very specific about what kind of permanent measure he would favor instead of this.
So in the meantime, people are going out to apply. There's like a over a $400 fee. And where do you think the biggest impact of this is going to be felt? Can you give me an example, you think, of where you think it'll be felt the most?
I think it'll be felt in a big way in the secondary schools and colleges where young people who were maybe fighting for some kind of relief or were not really telling anybody else about it will have some more security. They'll have a chance to work legally instead of trying to find a job under the table or something that's through a contract where they wouldn't have to use a social security number. That's a big change. I mean, supporters are hoping that this will encourage undocumented students to continue their education and look for the kind of jobs that they would want to do and that they're qualified to do.
Okay.
And I think it would, a lot of the people I've talked to said one of the benefits is being able to work, but another really huge benefit for them is just to not be always living in fear and kind of paranoid that police interaction could end up sending them into deportation proceedings. This will, while it's a temporary solution, it does give more security to people who want to, you know, continue focusing on their busy school lives or trying to find the kind of career that they've been looking to do.
That's Matt O'Brien, staff reporter with the Bay Area News Group. He spoke with KALW's Martina Castro. Listening to Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan. The Dreamers may now be eligible for work permits, but that doesn't change the dismal labor market they'll be entering. In July, the Department of Labor put the unemployment rate for people between the ages of 18 and 29 at 12%. And if you're between 16 and 19, it's nearly 25%. But on the employer side, companies complain they have open positions that go unfilled because they can't find the right talent. One organization thinks it's found a solution to the skills gap problem. It's helping young people who have a high school diploma or GED find jobs in growing sectors of the economy like technology and high finance. Youth Radio's Sarah Quevedo reports.
2 years ago, Brianna Scales says she was stuck between a dead-end job painting kids' faces at a theme park while trying to get through college.
If I had to work a lot, I wouldn't be able to do my homework. And if I had to go to school and do my homework, I wouldn't be able to afford rent.
Today, however, 23-year-old Scales has a job she loves at the San Francisco-based video game company Zynga, the Willy Wonka's chocolate factory of tech companies.
Oh, ginger ale, ginger pop, ginger beer, beer bubbles, bubble A, bubble cola, double bubble, burpa cola, and all the crazy carbonated stuff that tickles your nose.
Well, maybe it's not that fantastical, but I'm talking arcades, themed kitchens on every floor, and a giant light-up tunnel at the entrance. Her offices are enough to make me lose my composure.
Like, my head is spinning. Like, I feel like it would take me months and months to get over how awesome this space is.
Yeah, I still, every time I come in, I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
Zynga's portfolio of insanely popular games includes Words with Friends and Cityville, which is the project that Scales works on, doing something called Quality Assurance, or QA.
I had no idea that QA even existed, but once I had the experience inside of the company, then I knew that this is something I really like to do, and this is pretty much my life right now.
Scales says she's like a literary editor, except instead of reading a book and looking for bad grammar, she plays Zynga's video games and documents glitches before the games go public. So how did she go from painting faces at a theme park to working in high tech? It was thanks to a program called Year Up.
We help young adults learn skills in fields that we think will be expanding as the economy moves forward.
Gerald Chertavian is the founder of Year Up.
Very sadly, for many of our young adults, their potential can often be limited by their zip code or by the bank balance of one of their parents. Or indeed by the color of their skin.
Europe trains low-income 18 to 25-year-olds in 9 cities across the U.S. to work in corporate America. The second half of the year-long program is a paid internship at companies like JPMorgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Google.
We were able to speak with a senior executive in a corporation and say, if we could show you a pipeline of pre-trained, pre-screened, cost-effective talent, would you be interested?
But for students to even reach their internships, they first have to complete 6 months of rigorous classroom training. There, they learn things like IT desktop support and bug reporting, in addition to some less technical stuff like how to send professional emails, shake someone's hand, or how to speak up during a meeting. In other words, Europe interns learn how to walk the walk, and they wear the right shoes and slacks for it, too.
I feel uncomfortable now wearing jeans.
24-year-old Christian Ramos is a Europe intern at LinkedIn. He's wearing a pressed shirt, gray cardigan, and a pink tie. He sticks out among the Silicon Valley techies in their t-shirts and jeans. Ramos is an in-house IT guy. His job is to help LinkedIn employees who have problems with their mobile phones. Standing at his workstation, he reads through a job ticket from a worker who just lost his cell phone.
The policy is that he has to notify us right away. It's a lot of important information on there, and we need to make sure that we get that cleared up before anybody gets their hands on it.
Ramos has impressed his bosses. They've offered him a job once he completes his Europe internship next month. And he's loosening up in order to fit into the work hard, play hard culture at LinkedIn. When he transitions to full time, Ramos plans on losing the tie. For Cross Currents, I'm Sarah Quevedo.
That story was produced by Youth Radio from their new Options Desk, which reports on how young adults can get work. Do you have a job opening that needs to be filled? Let us know. Maybe we can match you up with the right talent. At least we were able to do that a few weeks ago for 10-year-old Lita Hernandez.
I really want to do it. I want to be a chef and a pharmacist. Well, maybe I could do part-time and then another part-time, but yeah, pretty much that.
Okay, so we didn't get her those jobs yet. But when listener Sharon Yeomans heard our profile of Lita on August 2nd, she sent us this message.
I'm calling to give my response to the introducing Lita Hernandez story. She's the 10-year-old from Oakland who said that she was interested in being a chef and a pharmacist. And I'm a pharmacist and a chef, and I was just so thrilled to hear those words come out of her mouth. I almost fell out of my chair, and immediately I felt like I needed to contact the radio station to see if I could arrange a meeting with her, because we do believe in recruiting them young. But it was just a heartwarming story, and it certainly touched my heart, and I'm happy to say that we are going to get to meet her and her family and start planting the seeds. But I, most of all, just to be an encouragement to her to pursue whatever her professional and educational dreams and goals are. So thank you for the story, and for both of us, probably our lives will never be the same. Thank you.
Our pleasure, Sharon. And you can get in touch with us about stories that touch you by calling 415-264-7106 and leaving us a message. Again, that number to leave us a message is 415-264-7106, and we'll try to get your story on the air. You can also reach us through our website, which is klw.org, and that's where you can hear the full story of Lita Hernandez. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. One thing you probably don't think of when you think of hospitals is garbage. And yet these huge institutions generate tons of waste that goes straight into our landfills. And according to this week's East Bay Express cover article, on average it takes 33 pounds of garbage to treat each patient. Reporter Kathleen Richards says the medical industry is one of the leading producers of waste, but it has been slow to recycle.
It's just an enormous amount of waste, you know. There are tons of plastic that's involved in, you know, medical items and devices. And part of the problem is that over the years, because of concerns of infectious disease, there has been a lot more plastic that's involved in patient, you know, in medical devices. So, for example, you know, all surgical instruments have to come wrapped in this blue wrap, which is this plastic, and that all gets thrown away. And, you know, when this adds up a lot, you know, when you're talking about either in the emergency room or just in basic patient care, there's all this plastic that's involved, and pretty much very little of it, almost none of it, is recycled.
And in your article, you say hospitals are like hotels, and it really hadn't occurred to me that way. They're really these mini cities that are huge users of energy and water and generators of waste.
Yes, and that's one area that hospitals are, you know, cutting down is, you know, their energy consumption and their water consumption, because they are one of the largest, you know, users of resources in the community. So, but, you know, when we think of hospital waste, we think of, you know, all the gross medical stuff, like, you know, needles and gauzes and any kind of tissues. But actually, that is a very small amount of a hospital's overall waste output. The majority is solid waste. And, you know, so garbage, food, things that could potentially be reduced, you know, either by recycling or, you know, switching to, you know, reusable items instead of disposable ones and that sort of thing.
Well, what surprised me in reading your article about this kind of culture of waste is that nobody really is looking at solving this. I think when you talked with doctors and nurses, they said this is just not part of our culture.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, there is a lot of movement. If you talk to people in the industry, you know, there are a lot of attempts now for medical supply companies, and also hospitals are looking at ways to reduce their waste because they're seeing it's an area that they can really save money. You know, this hospital waste adds up to enormous costs because it costs a lot to dispose of medical waste and to treat it. So places, hospitals and, you know, the medical supply companies are looking at ways to reduce this. But like I said, it's just so far behind, you know, what the rest of society is doing. And I think it is, for whatever reason, that just no one has held their feet to the fire. And I think in some cases, hospitals, you know, see it as something that's going to add to their bottom line because they've got to, you know, maybe train their staff or get extra bins, and that can add up as well. But in the long run, you know, experts agree that cutting down on waste would actually save hospitals and patients a lot of money.
So that may be the incentive that really gets this ball rolling. One thing that I read in your article was that 85% of the plastic in a hospital's waste stream has never even come into contact with a patient. And I think that you write that there's been an increase in non-recyclable materials so that they've moved to plastic, disposable, everything.
Exactly. Like I said, over the years, because of concerns of infectious disease, there's been this move towards plastic disposable items. So, for example, you know, scalpels now are disposable. They're used once and they're thrown away. And when you add all this up, it's so enormous. So, you know, a scalpel is used once, needles used once, and the containers that they're put into are also thrown away. And all this ends up in a landfill, essentially. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. You know, scalpels used to be disposable. You know, they were stainless steel and they'd be sterilized in an autoclave. And so, you know, people are starting to move back to those, you know, the old way of doing things, which was to sterilize and reuse things.
And yet a lot of what you seem to write about sounds like as the rest of society has moved forward and gone into much more recycling, the hospital industry has taken a step back. Can you start with telling us about the 1988 Medical Waste Tracking Act and what's happened since then?
Back in the 80s, you know, there weren't these strict standards when it came to medical waste disposal. And so on the East Coast, what was happening was that medical waste was washing up on the beaches because it was taken out onto barges and dumped in the middle of the ocean. So the Medical Waste Tracking Act was passed by Congress in 1988, and it helps sort of set up some of the standards, government regulation. That act only lasted until 1991, and then the states got the authority to regulate medical waste.
And so it seems like California generally is a leader in areas like that. Is that true here? Who's working to solve this?
Well, there are various organizations that are working on this issue. Practice Green Health is a national nonprofit, and they are, you know, trying to encourage hospitals to, you know, be more sustainable in various ways, and medical waste is one area. But in general, I was sort of surprised that there isn't more movement to encourage hospitals to cut down on medical waste. It seems like there's a real lack of A, awareness, and B, motivation. And I think part of it might be just the public's perception that, you know, hospitals are dealing with kind of this gross stuff, and, you know, they must be all these rules, and whatever they're doing must be fine. But when you really look at it and you realize that, you know, there's A, a lot of waste, and B, a lot of it could actually be reduced or recycled in some ways. And that C, you know, this is ending up in our landfills, or in the case of pharmaceuticals, you know, it's being trucked out of state and incinerated.
Kathleen Richards is co-editor of the East Bay Express, and she spoke with us about this week's cover story. You'll find it online at eastbayexpress.com, and you can also find a link to that article and all of our stories at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Hospitals definitely face challenges when it comes to disposing of their waste, but there's no denying that recycling can be a bit confusing for everybody, especially when you throw terms like biodegradable, natural, and compostable into the mix. If you see that on a label, does it mean it goes into the recycling bin or the compost bin? In this story from our archives, reporter Hadley Robinson headed out to a local green waste facility to figure it out.
The Sonoma Compost Company is just off Highway 101, northwest of Petaluma. All day, trucks haul in plant materials and haul out soil.
This here is our standard Sonoma compost, and this here is our high test that has was composted with the chicken feathers and has a 2.5% nitrogen in it, so it's great for vegetable growing.
Will Bax operates the compost facility, and to his mind, those incoming trucks are carrying two types of things. There's plant material and food scraps from kitchens and yards across Sonoma County. That's what the trucks are supposed to be carrying. Then there's what they're not supposed to be carrying.
Yeah, look at all that plastic, huh?
Yeah, it's a real problem.
Bax has been operating the Petaluma facility for 26 years. It processes about 300 tons of green waste a day. That's about 1,000 pickup trucks full. In the last few years, though, Bax and his crew have noticed an increasing amount of what's known as compostable plastic.
We have over here about 5 to 6 people working on it at the sorting before it goes in the grinder. And then I have still 1 to 2 people cleaning up between the windrows out here of compost.
Here's the thing. Bax doesn't take plastics, not any plastics. Instead, his employees spend lots of time picking out those supposedly compostable forks and bags and throwing them in the trash.
Whenever the window turner goes through it, it kind of pushes the plastic to the outside, and so we rake that up again.
That's right. If you dropped it in the compost bin in Sonoma County, the compostable fork you felt so good about using probably went to the landfill. Bax explains that when compost includes plastics, the resulting soil isn't considered organic. That means it can't be sold to organic farmers.
It is extremely effective in consumer confidence when they see that you go through the efforts of making it meet the standards for organic growing. It really enhances the confidence they have in these materials.
Apart from wanting to stay organic, Bax has a lot of hesitation about compostable plastics. He says they used to be made exclusively from plants, but that's changed as the industry has grown.
On a lot of products you will not see anymore that it says corn or potato, because they make compostable plastics out of oil-derived material right now, too. And so a lot of these compostable plastics are, some of them, 100% petroleum-based.
How can a compostable thing be petroleum-based?
The molecular structure is such that the microbes can consume it.
In other words, it isn't identical to oil, but it's derived from it. The city of San Francisco sees plastics in its compost differently.
There's almost no difference between a corn cob going in on one end with a corn cup and both coming out as finished compost.
Jack Macy is the city's commercial zero waste coordinator. Like a growing number of cities, San Francisco is trying to divert as much waste from landfills as possible. A plastic that is fully compostable, meaning it can be consumed by organisms within 180 days, achieves that goal. So San Francisco will take any plastic that meets this compostability standard, no matter what it's made from. Macy does have some concerns, mostly about consumer confusion. Companies like Coca-Cola now offer plastic bottles that they advertise as plant-based. They're not compostable, but the big green leaf on the logo might make you think otherwise.
Well, because it's plant-based, it actually doesn't change the final chemistry of that bottle, and it's just as a durable, non-degradable plastic as if it was made from petroleum. So it is not compostable or degradable in any meaningful sense.
Macy's other concern is over labeling.
So if you see the word degradable or biodegradable on a product, you should be very wary and not consider it compostable and really not use it.
Under a 2008 California law, plastics can't be labeled biodegradable and can only be labeled compostable if they meet specific standards, like completely breaking down within 6 months. Even so, many companies use the word biodegradable freely. This past October, Attorney General Kamala Harris put some teeth in the legislation, filing suit against three water bottle companies for mislabeling. Macy says consumers shouldn't let themselves be tricked.
To the extent that it might break down, it's even worse than a landfill. So it's not recyclable, it's not compostable, it's just as bad as litter. There's no benefit to its end of life. It's a greenwash, and don't waste your money on it.
There's a lot of money at stake here. Plastics that meet the compostable standard are more expensive. At Costco, 1,000 compostable forks cost nearly $65, while 1,000 regular plastic forks are $37. Will Bax of Sonoma Compost says this makes it even more important for people to know exactly what they're buying.
For the consumer, it's very important because they are paying extra money for these products. And, you know, it's like, are they just wasting it? I mean, literally taking it to the landfill? Or is it a good thing that they're doing it?
Bax also questions the whole concept of growing plastic from plants, just to turn it back into soil.
All the embedded energy of making it, growing the corn, which is a heavy fertilizer, you has heavy pesticide, use a heavy water user, then it needs to be processed, then there's the transportation. All of that energy is destroyed in the composting process.
And at that point, he says, composting those plastics might not even be worth it.
I would definitely look more at recycling them than composting them.
Every day we make decisions based on our environmental values. A wooden stirrer or a reusable spoon to mix your to-go coffee. Organic vegetables or local ones. We want the decisions to be straightforward, but sometimes they're not.
I think that people come from a good place. They, you know, it's like I think that most of us here, particularly the Bay Area, feel that whatever we can do to make a better environment, we are willing to pay a little extra for that. And so when you see compostable plastic, everyone knows that compost is good for the earth. Naturally, we think that we're doing the right thing.
The U.S. Composting Council is studying the impacts of compostable plastics. So in a few years, we may see new standards for what that term means. But for now, with everybody eager to save the earth, it's composters like Will Bax who are left holding the proverbial compostable trash bag. For Cross Currents, I'm Hadley Robinson.
What questions or tips do you have about reducing waste? You can let us know at our Facebook page. We're KALW News. Well. Oh, well. Well.
Oh, well. Well. Oh, well.
Lean forward slightly. Look straight at the speaker. And listen with a sparkle in your eye, as though you might be thinking, gee, this is the most wonderful thing I ever heard in all my life.
You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Hannah Ababa, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Emily Gaddick, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Artyom's Kunahoffs, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor, Martina Castro is our managing editor, and Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Thanks to our partners at the East Bay Express. You'll find them online at eastbayexpress.com. And thanks to you. Yes, you. We are listener-supported radio. Hey, I still love you so. Tune into Cross Currents today at 5. We'll go searching for the Bay Area's top falafel.
I make it, oh, yummy, I like it, and then I make it again and again, and I keep making.
That's today at 5 on Cross Currents.
I got purple in my swisher, purple in my cup, purple in my wine glass, purple label up, grapes, what's up, grapes, what's up, breakfast.
Oh, it's Cray, baby. Oh, hey, baby.
This is Oakland rapper Creation. She had a major music video hit in 2010 with over 3 million views in the first 3 weeks. Now she's back with another video, the first single from her new album. You can catch her live on Saturday at the Row Boutique Nightclub in San Francisco. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.
I'm hungry for this money. Call me Cray Hefner, Playboy Bunny. About that juice, cheese, bread, breakfast, stacking dough, breakfast. I got all the syrup. 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 About that juice, cheese, bread, breakfast, stacking dough. A in the morning.